Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
As he held open the door of the recreation hall, the fourth-year boy looked at me and smiled. Then he said, "I shouldn't worry about it. It could happen to anyone." It was kind of him, I suppose. I was in first year in boarding school, just 5 months in. It was a Sunday evening in February. There was snow outside. I hadn't seen home in 6 weeks, and I was a little bit sniffly. The reason I was sniffly was that I had a cold. I was one of 300 boys living in a big drafty building, and at that time of year, if you weren't outdoors getting pummeled in rugby training, you were likely to be indoors trying to keep warm. Catching a cold was no big deal. The fourth-year boy had thought I was crying. I wasn't crying, but a lot of boys were, including some of the big boys. Maybe particularly the big boys, furtively wiping their eyes as everyone filed out of the recreation hall and up to the dormitories to bed. The boarding school in Roscrea, run by the Cistercian Order, was a more Spartan place then than it would be now. It was a life of early mornings, daily mass, mandatory rugby, classes on Saturday. Respite came on Sunday evenings, after tea, when a big screen was unfurled in the recreation hall, the lights were switched off, and all 300 of us were treated to a movie, or, as it was known then, a film. The Sunday film took your mind off things. You'd stock up at the tuck shop with your Coke and crisps and chocolate and settle in with your pals in the standard-issue hard chairs for some 2 hours of John Wayne or Clint Eastwood or whoever. For the most part, they were films you'd expect boys to like. In that first year we had, for example, The Hornet's Nest, Support Your Local Gunfighter, and Jaws. But for one particular Sunday, the chilly polar Sunday that was 12th of February 1978, the Reverend Fathers decided that we would have something different. How about one of the weepiest romances of all time? How about Love Story? The plot of Love Story is simple enough. Rich kid, Harvard law student falls in love with working class girl. His family disapproves. They get married. She falls gravely ill. In the film's opening sequence, the man sits alone on a bench in winter snow and tells us his wife has died. No spoiler alert here. From the very beginning, you know where it's going. As the male lead, Ryan O'Neill is charming, handsome, plays ice hockey. Opposite him, Ali McGraw is witty, assertive, musically talented. Strong characters, then. We're on their side. Throughout, though, there is the mournful musical accompaniment that signals the impending tragedy. What are 300 boys to do? It's as though nobody saw this coming. And you can't just get up and leave. You don't want to get up and leave. I remember hearing a sob and looking round me. It was one of the older boys. Then another sob. And another. All older boys. At 13, I was only barely out of childhood. At that age, in boarding school and far away from home, well, you could be forgiven for shedding a tear or two. But that didn't mean I was going to cry about a girl, about something I saw in a film. All I could identify with in Love Story was the snow, which right then was as prevalent in Roscrea as it was in Boston. But the older boys, well, what was it with them? In the half century or so since it was made, the box office phenomenon that was Love Story has been celebrated and ridiculed in roughly equal measure. On a more recent, more mature viewing, I found it entertaining but flawed. There are unlikely leaps in the plot, and you'd have to wonder about some of the lines, like the most famous one, "Love means never having to say you're sorry." Really? Yet Love Story remains one of my most remembered films. I remember it because of the effect it had on the big boys at school. The sight of them, big lads crying into their crisps. The thing is, boys do cry. Even big boys cry. You might not want people to know, particularly when you're at school. Then you look around you and you see other boys crying too. As for me, though, whatever else I was doing on that Sunday evening long ago, I wasn't crying. I was only sniffling. You see, I had a cold. Thank you.
I never thought about how the Irish crossed the road before I moved away. It's not the kind of thing you think about, and it's certainly not the kind of thing that you think has any national character. But then I moved to Amsterdam, a city where the people are an obedient, unfussy kind, the sort to not question a rule, to enjoy a good system, the sort to wait for a red man even on an empty road. When I first moved to the Dutch capital, a professor advised me that one of the great difficulties of settling into the city would be adjusting to its rhythms. I wondered when it was that he'd last tried to set up a bank account or secure health insurance with the Dutch. The rhythms of the city, spoken like a true academic. But I found myself recalling his words in the weeks that followed, usually when I was crossing the road. I was out of sync with the rule-observing Dutch. My impulse to anticipate a traffic sequence for myself earned me disapproving looks from fellow pedestrians and one too many close shaves with outraged cyclists. The Dutch have little time for notion-taking. They're a straight-talking people who make plans and stick to them. You offer them a cup of tea and they will answer truthfully and directly. They're not expecting you to cajole a yes out of them and get very irritated when you try to do this. I admired the seamlessness of their way of life when I first arrived. They're very efficient, I'd report home. Buses arrive as scheduled and, oh, they hate nothing more than a queue. I was a parody of any Irish person to have ever moved there. I was sure that any displacement I felt could be quickly redressed by a cup of Barry's tea or a sneaky pint. I was surprised then by how reassured I was by the language of Dublin pedestrian life upon my return home. I found myself struck, maybe even charmed, by chancers waving down cars as if it was their God-given right to cross precisely where and when they wanted to, calculating traffic sequences as if it was some kind of puzzle waiting to be solved, as if the traffic lights weren't specifically there to do all of this work for them. In my wistful state of return, I found something poetic about the excessively long time the orange man bleeped on, a seeming acknowledgement of the specifically Irish understanding of this signal, which we take to mean speed up rather than slow down. In fact, how Dubliners crossed the road seemed to capture all that I had actually missed while I was away, and it was nothing a cup of tea or a pint could ever have replicated. Only in coming home did I realise that what I had really missed in all that time was the feeling of getting away with it. Just the possibility of it made me giddy again. For all my efforts to achieve the cool coherence of the Dutch, I'd been yearning for the wiggle room of it all. Go on, go on. Whatever you say nothing. Rules are made to be bent here. It's why we lose our minds at an all-you-can-eat buffet, slipping croissants into our pockets as if an apocalypse might strike before lunch. I mean, it had been over a year since a stranger had winked or rolled their eyes at me. So these days, I soak up the swagger of those who have just bent the traffic sequence to their will, the smug satisfaction of someone already walking across the road as the green man lights up. Witnessing these jammy victories has been the ultimate restoration since moving back. I love now getting to blitz past tourists who have stopped oh so earnestly at an orange man. I relish the in-joke satisfaction of knowing exactly when you're good to chance it on Thomas Street, or an understanding that there is simply safety in numbers when crossing O'Connell Bridge. I love getting away with it again, recognising the eye-bulging, brow-raising, Jesus look of it all. The rhythm of the place, I suppose. The girl's a fool, she broke the rules, she heard a lie. This time he will break down. She's lost his trust and so she bust all his laws. The system has broken down. Romance has
There is something very special about Parisian light. On the day I met her, a late spring sun had just cleared the rooftops opposite Marianne Faithful's apartment. It shone a spotlight on both her and the chair on which she sat. Her endless cigarette smoke drifted upwards and made a halo above her head. It wreathed itself about her in a way that a cat might sit upon a person's shoulder and insinuate itself about their neck. As she spoke, she conducted her words with the hand that held the cigarette. I had arranged our Paris meeting so that I might find out more about one of our long-time friends, a companion from the days when Marianne Faithfull was the toast of Soho and an icon of swinging London. The days when she was muse to the greats of rock music, a muse to Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones. She was the original wild child of the 1960s, and sometimes wild children attract those of similar disposition. In 2012, at Christie's Auction Rooms, London, a hammer came down on a Francis Bacon painting. The sale fetched a record-breaking price for a piece of his art. The painting, titled A Portrait of Henrietta Mores, was sold for 25 million euros. The subject depicts a young nude woman lying on a bed and is rendered with brutally visceral brushstrokes, a style typical of the artist. Like Marianne, Henrietta Mores was also a beautiful, troubled and seductive child of the 60s London set. She lived a bohemian life in the company of artists, poets and emerging rock musicians. It was in this community she first encountered Marianne. In the aftermath of Marianne's breakup with Mick Jagger in 1970, she and Henrietta shared a small squat in St. John's Wood, London, and supported each other through times of mutual addiction to alcohol and drugs. In the late 1970s, Marianne released the album Broken English and embarked upon a tour of Ireland's ballrooms and smaller music venues. She was accompanied by Henrietta, who acted as her tour manager. Reading accounts of this tour from Henrietta's autobiography, it would not be an exaggeration to state that the subsequent concerts were both an artistic and financial fiasco. This was why I had come to visit Marianne. Following Henrietta's death, where better to learn about an artist's muse than from another artist's muse? Although we spoke at length about Marianne's relationship with her late friend, it was about our visit to Kilkenny Castle in 1967 that our conversation kept returning. I recalled how our local paper featured herself and Mick Jagger on the front cover for weeks. In one such image, Marianne is seen standing beside Mick. She wears a long woven cloak, holds a plate of food, and as ever, a cigarette in her hand. On her head is an elaborate straw hat decorated with what appears to be real roses. I tell her how her presence in Kilkenny unsettled us teenage boys. She and Mick brought excitement, anarchy and colour to what we believed was a dull existence. We tuned into pirate radio stations at night beneath the bedclothes, trying to catch music as it faded in and out. Sound waves in our ears that might be like the swelling seas on which those pirate ships sailed. We counted the hours and we counted the days. We cut posters from fan magazines and tacked them to our bedroom walls. Naturally, Marianne was in a place of prominence. We adopted hippie fashion by altering the ordinary contents of drab wardrobes, wore flowers behind our ears, and when Marianne and Mick returned to their rock and roll lifestyles, we returned to chalk dust and classroom ennui. On that afternoon in Paris, much to her delight, I explained the lasting impact she had on our 17-year-old Christian brothers' educated lives. Before I bade farewell to her, Marianne offered me a Kilkenny anecdote. I suspect I might have heard it somewhere before, but for what it's worth, this is her story. Both herself and Mick were on a pub crawl during Kilkenny City's infamous beer festival. As they drifted between pubs, a pack of screaming girls appeared to be running after Mick. He ducked into a doorway, but was surprised that they passed him by unheeded, still screaming and still pursuing their quarry. When Marianne asked who they were chasing, a bystander told her that the girls thought they'd glimpsed Dickie Rock and wanted his autograph. At that time in Kilkenny, Dickie might have been more famous than Mick. However, Marianne was proud that her song Dreaming My Dreams remained number one in the Irish music charts for 7 successive weeks in 1976. Written for her by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, it was her only number one hit anywhere in the world. By the time I closed her front door, the sun was setting. Crossing the street, I looked back and saw a light had come on in her apartment. Through the open window, I believe I could hear her singing, and yes, There was a warm wind blowing through Paris, and it seemed to carry a trace of tobacco smoke on its breath.
Charity Hop. When the girl with blue hair jingled the decrepit old piano to life in the charity shop, we lifted our faces from tired rummaging amongst the rails of deadbeat blouses. We might as well have been in Tootsie's Orchid Lounge, Nashville, as she plucked out the ragtime classic, Scott Joplin's Entertainer. We picked up the tune, two-stepped to her cheerful rhythms, swayed to her offbeat honky-tonk. The girl with blue hair flashed a smile of studs, bowed as we applauded her performance. Blue kisses from tattooed fingertips to the old man who raised his frayed cap and called her a great girl entirely.
The American Jesuit, Father Daniel A. Lord, a religious consultant to Cecil B. DeMille, was not enamoured by the arrival of talking films. Silent smut had been bad, he declared many years later in his autobiography, but vocal smut cried to the censors for vengeance. Father Lord helped establish the rules within films called the Hays Code of Behaviour in the 1930s. This ensured that, among other things, if an on-screen husband leaned over his wife who was in bed, the husband, like a professional snooker player, was required to keep one foot on the ground. When Ireland's first film censor was asked if he knew anything about film, he replied huffily, "No, but I know the Ten Commandments." His successor, a doctor, could at least claim one direct connection with Hollywood. When Audrey Hepburn once fell from a horse while filming a scene in Wicklow, he was called upon to administer an injection to her bruised posterior. But while Irish censors obsessed about protecting young people's morals from the temptations of sensuality, back in America, the industrious Father Lord was learning, through films, that sensuality sells. If it could sell films, cars and soap powder, the good father asked himself, why could it not also be used to sell chastity? As somebody not prone to idleness, Lord tested his concept by sitting down to type a succession of pamphlets aimed at teenagers. This ensured that the previously staid Catholic Truth Society pamphlets would never quite be the same again. Father Lord knew the tricks to attract young people's attention in the 1940s and 50s. In the heavily censored Ireland of those years, what boy or girl could resist peeking at his Catholic Truth Society pamphlets when he tantalised them with titles like Nobody Loves a Tease, What to Do on a Date, Fashionable Sin, or So We Abolished the Chaperone? The Irish editions of his pamphlets may have required some editing. In the Australian text of What to Do on a Date, Lord's wise pipe-smoking priest and two teenagers discussed the dangerous practice of park and neck in their father's borrowed car. This practice was less widespread and glamorous in rural Ireland, where the main means of transport was often the crossbar of a bicycle, and the boy, like any snooker player or Hollywood husband, needed to keep one foot on the ground, although more for the sake of balance than decency. The advice contained in these pamphlets was not exactly progressive. In one pamphlet entitled What Not to Do on a Date, the Jesuit Father McLean outlined his F-E-A-R rule. If kisses are frequent, enduring and ardent, there can hardly be any just reason for them. This would seem comical if such works hadn't helped create the repressed moral environment where, as novelist Edna O'Brien has recalled, as a girl she viewed her body as a sort of tabernacle of sin. In a pamphlet entitled Questions Young Girls Ask, Father Thomas Finnegan declared that to love is to suffer. He devised an easy way for girls to keep lustful thoughts at bay. Domestically minded girls should shift their thoughts to deciding what colour schemes they would like in their homes after marriage, while sporty girls should fantasise that a rich uncle was buying them a car and focus their thoughts on the merits of the different models available. However, the seductively alluring style of the cover suggests that some designers involved would have been prized by Don Draper and his fellow venal advertising executives in the Mad Men television programme. It seems strange that while the conservative Irish Catholic Truth Society understood the attractiveness of such art to a young audience in the 1950s, in that same decade the Irish Arts Council appeared to have not yet grasped the power of commercial art, condemning the modernist posters for Aer Lingus as having little artistic merit. The Irish Catholic Truth Society preached chastity by commissioning teasingly striking artwork by Irish artists like George Monks, Sean Best and Alfred Monaghan, pamphlet covers that looked as tantalising as any pulp fiction. Sadly, the earnest authors of such pamphlets as I Have Left School, The Young Lady Says No, or the mysteriously entitled Sister Felicitas Wins a Bicycle, which conjures up images of a nun making a mad dash for freedom, are forgotten today. But what remains cherished by connoisseurs of commercial and pop art are the alluring cover images produced by artists who seem to play with just how far they could push the limits of their design brief. These drawings prove that while the devil may be said to produce the best tunes, God, it could be argued, produces the best covers.
Mam and Daisy are in the shop looking at photos from their week in Spain. They're laughing, but stop when I put my head around the door. I'm trying not to let the bottles of Smirnoff and tonic clink together because Mam doesn't want Daisy to know that she hasn't got a drink in the house. I'm not sure why. They're sitting at the table beside the till. Most of the shop lights are off, so I can't see the wool skirts on the circular rail, nor the longer dresses to my left. I can see the stand with the iron-on yellow smiley faces and Mam dressed in her usual black polo neck under the spotlight from the window. And in the window, mannequins like people with their backs to us. "There's a stew," Mam says. "I'll be in a minute." As I leave, Daisy says, "My God, that girl looks lovelier every time I see her." I make my way down the dark corridor to the kitchen and sitting room behind the shop. I like Daisy for this and because she used to let me babysit for her girls. And when I play the piano, she tells me I am a genius. Some part of me thinks that I might have some genius in me, but it's very well hidden. I put the bottles on the kitchen counter and take the lid off the stew. There's a hard white fat on top. I get a spoon and start to scrape it off. "That will melt back in," Mom says, coming through the door. "We used to put that dripping on our bread when I was a child. It's good for you." She pours out vodka, then tonic, rummages in the freezer for ice, and the tonic fizzes around the cubes when she drops them into the glasses. ice and heels clicking, she goes back down the corridor already talking. She might as well have another one. Jim can run you home. Dad is probably in the gym trying to pretend that he's fit and young. I wish we could all sit in front of the telly in the den upstairs like we used to, eating one of Dad's curries and watching something funny. When I walk in on my mother and her friends or people from the shows, I feel like I'm part of some play she's writing in her head. Sometimes I'm the pain in the ass teenager. Other times a gifted dancer just like her. I'm never sure of my part, my lines. But now there seems to be some other play going on, and the props in this play are glasses of vodka and photographs from the holiday that I have not yet seen. I eat even though Mags and I are on a diet, but I'm failing at this and in school, and there will be hell to pay if I don't get to my school report before Dad sees it. I should do some homework, but instead I go into the sitting room to play records on the stereo. Mum is sitting on her green velvet sofa. Dad must be gone with Daisy. "Did you see the photographs?" she says, holding them up. I walk over. "No." "This is the place we were staying." Mum and Daisy are posing in front of a swimming pool. Mum is wearing a big sun hat, tilted of course, the brim shading one side of her face. Annoyingly, that same style of hat suits my face as well. I've tried others, but this big brim thing is the only one that looks okay. And this is Stein's boat. He took us out most days. I take in the small yacht, white sails against the indigo sky, and the silhouette of a man. Something in me stills like a cat when another cat has entered their territory. This is a better photo of him. There he is. A middle-aged, blonde, grey-haired man with light blue eyes. She's waiting to see what I will say. I say nothing. He was lovely. He's lovely, isn't he? Her eyes are swimmy and unfocused, and I'm starting to realise that I am in the new play. No, I'm in the audience or the pub afterwards, and she's telling me what it was like to be centre stage again. What it was like to play opposite a new leading man with kind blue eyes. One part of me even understands. I touch the velvet of the sofa where my fella and I were kissing late on Saturday night when they were all asleep upstairs, and I'm thinking, this is my time to fall in love, not yours. I make a point of looking away from the photo and over at the orange lamp glowing softly like the evening sun in Spain. "He's Dutch," she says. "I have to do homework." But she's not looking at me as I make a flouncy exit stage right. She's looking at the photograph.
Harmonia Mundi. Oh, to be okay in the world's glory. In Paris, in La Dame Blanche record shop, pulling out the teak drawers of records. Okay with not being able to choose, because take one, take Ornette, away from all the other jazz from A to Z. Take one, Charpentier, from the drawer where also lives Couperin and Harmonia Mundi, which must mean the harmonies of the world. And I could cry at the appositeness of that. And you only have a slice of this everything. Staggered because being here means that. As I begin to understand on the metro, watching the shine on the lip of a small, overalled man and all there is. Taking part in it like the creperie waiters leaning at the lamppost back of the Pantheon. As a woman walks by and leaves perfume and heels sound, and perhaps a sense that in this top with the shoulder straps today, she has something. Thinking I may never be known, and content on this road of my conversation with everything. and the taste in a sugared crepe, that was not the taste I wanted, but is the taste of here and so to be never forgotten. Nor the tambourine sound in back of the day, the waitress coming out to the path here on earth to shout, "Hey, oh, oh," at the truck going up the street in the wrong direction.
On this morning's programme, we heard When Love Story Came to School by Fergal O'Doul. Getting Away With It was by Molly Fury. One Day with Marianne by Joe Carney. The Charity Hop, a poem by Margaret Galvin. Judging Books by Their Covers by Dermot Bulger. Photograph of Stein by Lani O'Hanlon. And Harmonia Mundi, a poem by Yvonne Cullen. The music was The Theme from Love Story by Francis Lay, Old Town by Phil Linnett, The Ballad of Lucy Jordan by Marianne Faithful, The Entertainer by Scott Joplin, played by Emma Johnson on clarinet with John Lenihan on piano, The Mad Men Theme by David Carbonara, and Tango No. 2 by Isaac Albanez, played by Pepe Romeo on guitar. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back on the RTE radio app or on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.